You are listening to Radio Aryan for an alternative to the anti-white system. On RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome once again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, to the Rope Report, Billy's Balkanization Podcast, brought to you each week exclusively on RadioAryan.com. And we're also able to produce YouTube video versions of the Rope Report downloadable through the Billy Roper YouTube channel, as well as Gustav Johansson's YouTube channel. If you're not able to access the internet, and go to RadioAryan.com to listen to the live podcast each Wednesday at 3 p.m. Central Time. On this week's The Rope Report, we're going to talk about Thanksgiving and the history of the holiday, what our plans are for this upcoming event. So this is the Thanksgiving special for The Rope Report, but first I'd like to do something that is usually done by mainstream media towards the end of every year. They talk about all the celebrities and the well-known people who have died in that year. At the end of 2017, we're almost to December now, a lot of celebrities have passed away this year. A lot of them, of course, are, you know, not at all missed. Glad to see them go and hope they're burning in hell forever. A few of them we will miss because when they died, you know, it gave me a sense of certain nostalgia. It reminded me of my childhood a bit. And some of the names may not be familiar to you at all. But this idea was really brought home to me this morning when it was announced that Charles Manson had died at the age of 83. Now, Charles Manson, of course, was most famous not for being a singer, even though he did put out quite a few songs and wrote lyrics for the Beach Boys. Some people say that the Beach Boys stole his lyrics. But Charles Manson was most famous for leading the gang that killed Sharon Tate. And actually, the idea that Manson was trying to put forward was that even then, he recognized a race war was coming, that whites and blacks would fight it out, and only one really would survive. Unfortunately, Charles Manson bet on the wrong horse. He took the lyrics of the Beatles, especially the song Helter Skelter, those of you may be familiar with it. When you get to the bottom, you go back to the top of the slide, then you stop and you turn and you go for a ride, you get to the bottom and I'll see you again. He believed the lyrics of Helter Skelter were actually the Beatles' attempt to prophesy and forecast a coming race war that he believed, with his help, blacks would win. And then he, being one of the few surviving whites, would have the opportunity to lead civilization. Well, didn't work out quite the way that old Chuck planned, and ended up dying today in prison. But his nostalgic figure was really iconic, regardless of what you think about him, as was the figure of Mel Tillis, the country music superstar whose death was announced yesterday. My mom actually played with Mel Tillis, and even if you don't remember his songs, you may remember his character that he developed where he really lampooned himself and made fun of his speech disability, his stuttering, made it actually into a pretty successful comedy routine. So as Mel Tillis and as Charles Manson pass away, and we get to close to the end of 2017, we're reminded of some of the other celebrity deaths from this year already, like Miguel Ferrer and Mary Tyler Moore and John Hurt and Mike Connors. Some of you may recall Barbara Hale or Richard Hatch, Bill Paxton, or even Chuck Berry. Lowell Albright, Don Rickles, Aaron Morin, Powers Booth, Dinah Morrell, Roger Moore, Roger Smith, Adam West, Martin Landau, Glenn Campbell, Jerry Lewis, Richard Anderson, Hugh Hefner, Monty Hall, Fats Domino, Robert Guillaume, and John Hillerman. As you get older and your sense of nostalgia grows, you'll understand that these people, whether you like them or hate them, whether they were positive or negative for our race, actually leave marks upon your life. And when they pass, you actually notice more and more because it brings to light your own mortality as time moves faster and faster. And the deaths of all these celebrities, none of whom I really know personally, or none of them really, to be honest, mattered to me insofar as changing my life in and of themselves, does bring home to me the shortness of the time that we all have here on Earth. The fact that all of us are heading into that great unknown and will face the answer to that big question that we all ask, internally at least. And in between now and then, when the lights go out forever, we only have a very limited amount of time. We don't know how finite our days or our hours here on Earth are. But we do know that the things that we do with our time really do matter. And we don't need to waste whatever time we have left. We have roles that we have to play. We have dharma that we have to fulfill. We have duties and responsibilities that we need to live up to. And one of our foremost duties and responsibilities as white people is to awaken and red pill our people, and also to white pill them, to encourage them that we are going to win this thing. And they need to stand up with us and to speak up with us and to fight alongside us. The best thing that I could have thought of to done with my life is what I ended up being, what I ended up doing. I did not really intend to take this route. I intended to be a college history professor, and things happened, as they do in life, that led me in this direction. And I feel, with my perspective of 30 years later, that it was the hand of God, that it was my destiny, it was my dharma to be a white nationalist and a white nationalist leader and spokesperson. And it may be yours as well. But whatever role your destiny, God's design, has set aside for you, whatever road He has laid out in front of you, I encourage you to make being a patriot for your race an important part of that road and that path you take, because we do not know how much time we have. And you may think that, well, once I retire, once the kids get out of the house, once I don't have so much things in my life, my job, my hobbies, my friends taking up my time, then I'll devote myself to my race. You may think, well, I will move to that wider area once I get the boat paid off, once I have the mortgage paid off. It may be too late. You may not have an opportunity if you wait until it's easy, because it's never easy. You just have to do it. You just have to make it your commitment. You have to make it your priority and not wait until it's too late. You know, the graveyards and cemeteries are full of people who have that last momentary regret because they waited too long to do what they'd always intended to do. And then time ran away from them and ran out. So don't be like the majority of people who end up having regrets, who end up wishing that they had stood up and spoken up, because I promise you, when the time comes for you, when you're about to die and you have those last few moments to look back on your life and it passes before your eyes, you're not going to think, oh, I wish I'd been a little bit more politically correct. I wish that I had not offended quite so many people. You're not going to think to yourself, you know, I just wish that I'd been a little bit more loving of diversity. I wish that I had ducked my head and kept my mouth shut a few more times. You're not going to say, I wish I would have stepped off the sidewalk and not said what I really felt. You're going to regret every inaction, every failure of courage, and every failure of conscience that you ever experienced. You're going to regret not taking every opportunity to speak up and to stand up and to tell the truth to the people you care about, to your friends and your family members, to give them the opportunity to better their lives and to help fight for the future of our race. Don't have those regrets. Make sure that you spend whatever time you have wisely and valiantly about something that really matters, not about what's on TV or what sports teams you're a fan of, not about frivolous social wastes, but about our cause, our people, and our race. So I hope that as we get closer to the end of 2017, and all these celebrities are passed before our eyes one more time to remind us of who we have lost, let's remember that what we've really lost, most of all, is time. Many of us have lost time that we've wasted this year that we could have and should have spent fighting for our race, which is really, to me, and probably to many of you as well listening to my voice, the most important cause and the most important use of our time possible of all. So, as 2017 ends, make sure that you make that New Year's resolution for 2018 to spend more time and more courage standing up for our people so that will not have been a waste. Now, as you get ready to join me in 2018, we still have a few events coming up to close out 2017. And this week's The Roper Report, Billy's Balkanization podcast, is focused on Thanksgiving because it will be released the day before that holiday. A lot of people think of Thanksgiving as being a stereotypically American holiday celebrating gluttony, an opportunity to just see how much you can stuff yourself with. But it's not really just about eating. It's not only just about food if you're not completely divorced from your people's heritage and culture, and most importantly, their history, then you at least probably have some kind of faint recollection of hearing something in school about the Pilgrims and maybe the Mayflower, and there's a reason why there's turkey involved. But let's get behind some of the politically correct BS and some of the cultural, monopolized, Jewish-controlled media lies about Thanksgiving and talk about the truth. Boiling it down into a summarized and concise description of the origin of the holiday, without trying to memorize names and dates too much, what is the takeaway about Thanksgiving? Well, Thanksgiving is a way of remembering our ancestors, specifically our Pilgrim Puritans ancestors' survival of their first year, but it was really a close-run thing. In the middle of the Protestant Reformation, after the Anglican Church or the Church of England had broken off from the Roman Catholic Church because King Henry VIII, you know, had six wives and had a hard time trying to produce a male heir, so he kept wanting to divorce one to think the next one might be able to give him a son. But the Roman Catholic Church did not want to have all these divorces on his record, didn't want to approve of them. So finally, in order to really try to have more chances to produce a male heir, Henry VIII broke off from the Roman Catholic Church and started the Church of England. But there was always this give and take over the next couple of generations, really, between those British rulers and nobles who wanted to return back to Catholicism and those who were content to go their own way with a new Protestant branch of the Roman Catholic Church, the Church of England. And some of the subsequent kings and queens wanted to almost oppress Protestants, and some wanted to oppress Catholics. So you had this slow, simmering warfare, religious warfare going on in England after King Henry VIII. And we all know how that led to not just his daughter, Elizabeth, actually having the war with Spain, but even after that, eventually you have within the Anglican Church some who wanted to kind of become a Roman Catholic Church light, and some who were more Calvinist in their thinking, were actually more opposed to the original 95 thesis that Martin Luther tapped up on that church door 500 years ago. Anyway, remembering that the Roman Catholic Church and the Anglican Church were splitting apart, you have, again, a new schism taking place within the Anglican Church. And this is what I use to remind people all the time who want to whine and complain about how much infighting there is in the white nationalist movement and why can't we all just get along and have the big tent and live under one umbrella and maybe have one huge organization, combine all of our people and our resources and our capital together and just win this thing, because we just really should put aside our differences. Well, they don't understand human nature. Here in America, if you go into any relatively small town, you'll see 10 to 12 different church denominations. You'll see Baptist, and within Baptist, you'll see Free Will Baptist, and First Baptist, and Second Baptist, and Missionary Baptist, and General Baptist, and Primitive Baptist, and you'll see Methodist, and Episcopalian, and Presbyterian, and Church of God, and Church of Christ, Lutheran. You get the point. It's not just us who can't get along. It's human nature. Even within Christianity, even within Protestant Christianity, there are divisions and schisms where literally within a block of each other, in the same small town, you will have one group of people who believe the people next door to them are going to hell because they disagree about what day of the week to celebrate or how many saints there are or whether there are saints at all or how to pray. All these small differences add up to balkanization, human nature, separation, free will. Well, that was also the case in the Anglican Church, and some of the Puritans, who by their name you can imagine thought of themselves as being like me, purity spiralers, were oppressed by the ruling regime in England, so much so that they first went to the Netherlands to try to be able to practice their culture, their religious worldview, their theological imperative there. And they found out that, like us, their kids were getting corrupted by popular culture, and they weren't able to build the kind of religious communities they wanted to have to carry forward their Puritan ethos there in Amsterdam. So they actually ended up taking ship to the New World, to New England. Now, because of a storm, they were going to go to the Virginia colony. It would have been a lot warmer for them and a lot better farming, a lot better climate, but they got blown off course by a storm and went a lot further north than they'd intended to. This is the, you know, the first quarter of the 1600s, so not a lot of exact science involved in crossing the Atlantic at this point. It's basically, you know, land where you can. And they landed in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, a place called Plymouth Rock. Now, their adventure is important because they actually wrote what was considered to be the first constitution, the first voluntary agreement about government ever composed in North America, called the Mayflower Compact. And it was a way for the religious Puritans and the secular, really non-religious sailors on board the ship, the Mayflower, to get along and to form a community. But they wrote it after a very hard experience. And that's what's behind Thanksgiving. You see, originally, when they landed, they had what we would consider to be kind of a communist ideal. They thought that they would just combine all of the resources, combine all of their food, and then dole out, ration out food to whomever needed it. Now, obviously, that creates an inequality of outcome, and an inequality of resources really creates jealousy, creates envy, and leads to conflict, because people are not equal. They aren't equal in their contributions. They aren't equal in their efforts. What they found was that while some people worked really hard to try to cut down trees, to break open ground, to raise crops, other people, knowing that they were all going to get fed the same amount, would sit and watch. And so, obviously, the people who worked hard to grow the food were resentful of those who did not work and still expected to be fed. Sounds kind of familiar? Well, it's human nature once again. This is a universal cyclical struggle, folks. We're no different from them 400 years ago. We're the same human beings, the same frailties, the same weaknesses, and jealousy and envy and laziness and sloth are part of those weaknesses. Well, the result of their communist experiment was that that first winter in the New World, about half of the pilgrims died. As a matter of fact, all but six of their women died that winter. And so they were just about on the edge of giving up. They thought that they're going to have to go back to England and try to have a life there. Then they decided that rather than give up, with a few resupplies, they would dedicate themselves into freeing up resources and not forcing people into this communist establishment, this communist, really neo-Bolshevik economic system before there were Bolsheviks. And let's get one thing straight. There were no Jews on board the Mayflower. We can't blame the Jews for this one. This was white people being stupid and believing in egalitarianism without the Jews forcing them to. So what happened with the failure of the first winter when about half the pilgrims died was that they began to work harder. They began to let nature reward individual effort with its own success. And so the next year, they had a successful harvest and they knew that they were going to be able to bring in enough food to survive. Now, here's where things get un-PC. Because in public schools today, kids are taught that the pilgrims only survived because of the generosity and kindness of the Native Americans. That apparently, you know, these pilgrims, these arbiters of Western civilization who crossed the ocean in a wooden ship, had never even learned how to fish or grow corn or wipe their ends by themselves. So the Indians had to teach them everything. Obviously, that is not only a tantamount exaggeration, it's a complete lie. Very little of the agricultural success or any other success of the pilgrims or the Puritans in the Mayflower colony came from their contact with the Indians. And quite the contrary. They found one Indian named Squanto who could speak English because he had been the only survivor of his tribe after they had died out from disease. He had previous contact with Englishmen. And so he showed them around a little bit, and like anyone going into a new land, that was helpful. But it's not as if their success or their survival depended on the Native Americans. Now, the fact is, they actually invited only Squanto to their Thanksgiving dinner. But Indians being Indians even then, he invited 100 other Indians in his new adopted tribe. So they all showed up. So listen, if you throw a Thanksgiving feast this year and you have a whole bunch of uninvited guests show up and surprise you, don't feel like you're the Lone Ranger. Feel more like you're Tonto, because that's exactly what happened in the very first Thanksgiving when the pilgrims invited just Squanto and he brought 100 other Indians with him to kind of crash the party. And they did not bring enough food to feed themselves, much less anyone else. So that kind of put a damper on the celebration, but still, Thanksgiving was not really a purposefully multiracial kumbaya love fest. Thanksgiving was an opportunity for the pilgrims, the Puritans, to celebrate their survival the first year, the fact that they had gathered in enough from their harvest to prepare to survive the second winter that was coming, but most importantly, to give thanks, just like the name says. To give thanks to God for their survival. To give thanks to God for the new land that they had found, that they had found a way to survive in. This new land that would allow them to follow their conscience, to practice their faith however they wanted to without being told by a king or by nobles or by any other religious hierarchy with which they disagreed how they should pray or how they should worship. So the pilgrims, the Puritans from the Mayflower, really had the first Thanksgiving to give thanks to God. It was not a secular holiday. It was not purposefully a multiracial holiday. It was a celebration of their survival and giving thanks for the new life that God had made possible for them in the new land, in the New England area, which is now Massachusetts. So, I know that your kids in school, especially in public school, are going to be taught the politically correct version that the Indians save the pilgrims and they all hold hands together. Yeah, not really. Squanto was the Indian who was, you know, marginally helpful. He was more than adequately rewarded for his helpfulness to the pilgrims. And when he was invited to Thanksgiving, he had 100 other Indians show up too, which, you know, the end result of that was that the pilgrims kept giving and giving and feeding these Indians until 47 years after the first Thanksgiving, the Indians revolted and went to war in an anti-white genocidal war against the pilgrims and their descendants. It was called King Philip's Rebellion. And in King Philip's Rebellion, the Indians did their level best to kill all of the white settlers in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. They failed, and the repercussions were pretty harsh for them. This proved that after Thanksgiving, people are people. Different races cannot and should not intermingle or get along. And you know, 47 years later, they were at each other's throats again, literally their descendants killing the descendants of their enemies. No more Thanksgiving holidays for Squanto's descendants or the descendants of the pilgrims, right? They did not share too much. But this is once again the eternal flow of human nature. And I know that when we look at history, we think of something, oh, in the 1600s. How could we possibly relate to people in the 1620s? We seem to think that they were like cavemen, completely different from us, but they were exactly the same as us. They have the same brains, the same hearts, the same mentality, the same psychology to a large degree, the same desires, the same dreams and wishes, the same fears, and the same faults as we do, just like us, just in a different time and place. And we have to recognize that those eternal truths about race, about culture, and about religion, which are true today, were true then, and will always be true. So Thanksgiving is, to me, an opportunity to remember our heritage and our history here in the New World and the very wonderful blessings that God has given us just as He gave them to our ancestors, and to remember that it's our responsibility and our duty not to squander them on non-whites, because this whole continent was made for us. Now, as you prepare to celebrate Thanksgiving with your family, I hope that you'll enjoy your loved ones. We're going to have about 36 of our friends and family come in. And actually, only about 12 of those are going to be blood kin. My mom and my brother and his wife and a couple of my nephews and their wives and children. But the rest of the people that we're having Thanksgiving with this week are actually members of the Shieldwall Network and their families. They're my friends. They're people who are involved in this white nationalist racial struggle with me. And some of them are bringing their whole families. A few of them we invited specifically because they don't have families. They don't have families in the region, or perhaps not at all, that they can celebrate Thanksgiving with. And we wanted them to not be alone on Thanksgiving, so we made sure that we opened our celebration to them. So this Thanksgiving, we'll have current count around 30 or so people together. Over half of them are our white nationalist comrades and their families. We hope that you all enjoy your Thanksgiving celebration as much as we will enjoy ours, with people who matter to you, people who you care about, and people who care about you. And I hope that all of you will remember our people's heritage and culture and history and everything that our ancestors went through, all of their sacrifices, all of their struggle, their fighting, their starving, their wars, so that it would be possible for us today to have life. And as you remember them on your Thanksgiving, spending time with your friends and family, I hope that you'll also remember the children around you, because they represent our future. They represent the future of our race. And it's crucial that we make sure we have a world worth handing down that we can give to them as their inheritance, that we not squander their birthright before they're old enough to take it. There's a generational conflict between millennials and boomers over who dropped the ball. Boomers actually blamed the World War II generation, which gave birth to them, which are called the greatest generation, because they're the ones, of course, who fought to save the world from Nazism, and they actually bled and died to save communism and the Jews. It's, again, human nature, and again, cyclical, to try to blame the generation that came before you for dropping the ball and for not doing what they should have done. But the reality is, we need to focus on doing what we are supposed to be doing now. In 2017, I have wasted some time. In 2018, I hope to waste less. I encourage you to take this time to look at what you have spent time on this last year and to see if all of it has been managed as well as it could or should have been, and perhaps reprioritize your schedule and how much time you spend working for our children's future. Now, in addition to Thanksgiving coming up, we have some birthdays in the family. We'll be celebrating them with our friends and family over the next couple of weeks. And we're also looking forward to Christmas coming very soon. So I know that everyone is busy during this holiday season. I'd like to encourage you to stay focused on those who are behind the wire, who are locked up and won't be around their families for Thanksgiving and Christmas this year. And specifically, as always, I want to remind you to remember Jacob Goodwin. Now, Jacob Goodwin, of course, has now, as many of you are aware, been extradited to Virginia and sits in a jail in Charlottesville awaiting the opportunity to have his day in court and hopefully to come back home a free man soon. Let me give you a quick update on how that transpired, because there's a little bit of a humorous story involved. When the Arkansas governor, Asa Hutchinson, signed the extradition papers, the rumor began in the federal level of law enforcement that I and the Shieldwall Network were going to be holding a rally or protest to block Jacob's extradition to Virginia. And it really got blown out of proportion, I guess through exaggeration or through the desire for drama, wanting an adrenaline rush, that U.S. Marshals Service told the Lone Oak County Sheriff's Department that I was going to try to stop the extradition by having a rally or protest on the day that Jacob was going to be moved. So in the middle of the night before, they woke Jacob up from a sound sleep and told him to put on his shoes and grab a couple of his shirts. He had to leave the rest of his personal effects behind. They wouldn't let him take him. And so he took him in the dead of night, in darkness, before dawn, from the county jail to the city jail and hid him out there. The U.S. Marshals then, a couple hours later, stuck him into an armored van and took him to the airport. Now, he had been planning on being moved by van 14 hours from Lone Oak County to Charlottesville. A two-day trip, really. That was what had been scheduled and what they'd been telling him would happen. But I guess because of their paranoia that I was somehow going to do a massive jailbreak, they put him on a plane instead. He had two stopovers and went from Little Rock to Dallas-Fort Worth to Charlotte, and then from there to Charlottesville, into three different states. So the U.S. Marshals, I guess, had a fun day of it and got some taxpayer-funded overtime and a free plane ride or two. But that evening, Jacob was in Charlottesville and able to call his mom and let her know that he was okay. He's being held in a housing unit there with the five other Charlottesville co-defendants. And I do have the address that you can use to write to Jacob Goodwin. So please grab a pencil or a pen and a piece of paper, and you can send a letter or a postcard to Jacob Goodwin. Now, here's my request. I want Jacob to receive as many Christmas cards as possible this year. His next hearing is December the 14th. What happened was he got there one night and they told him immediately that he's going to have his first hearing the very next morning before he even had a chance to meet with his lawyer or to get an attorney, which is an obvious attempt through what I called last week on the Rope Report podcast, extraordinary rendition and diesel therapy to exhaust and to intimidate a prisoner into getting a guilty plea. Now, it did not work. Jacobs pled not guilty, and he has his next hearing December the 14th at 2 p.m. in the Charlottesville court. And he'll be there with the other co-defendants, as well as, ironically, DeAndre Harris and Corey Long, who were also arrested in the melee. So, Jacob Goodwin's address, where I'd like to ask you to send Christmas cards and postcards and letters, is Jacob Goodwin, prisoner number 634728. The address is 160 Perigory, that's Perigory Lane, Charlottesville, Virginia, 22902. Once again, that's Jacob Goodwin, prisoner number 634728, 160 Perigory Lane, Charlottesville, Virginia, 22902. So Jacob is in housing there. He actually can accept phone calls for 50 cents a minute. So if you'd like to, you can actually call him at 434-260-6640. Once again, that number is 434-260-6640. Now, I want to thank everyone who's been helping out with the Legal Defense Fund through GoFundMe and through FundedJustice.com. You can also send legal defense donations in to his parents. But right now, they actually have enough of a legal defense fund built on that they'd like to ask you to help Jacob out directly with his commissary funds, if you are able. Now, you can go to www.albemarle.org. That's albemarle.org. And click on the Inmate Canteen Fund. Or you can just Google Inmate Canteen Fund at Albemarle County, Virginia. And it will tell you specifically how you can make donations through jailatm.com to help out with Jacob Goodwin's commissary fund through his prisoner ID number, which I just gave you. And this gives him an opportunity to get extra food other than what they just slop onto his plate, as well as things like socks and underwear and other necessities which the prison does not provide. So you can go to the Albemarle County, Virginia Inmate Canteen Fund and use jailatm.com to make contributions directly to Jacob Goodwin's commissary fund. I encourage you to send him a postcard or a letter, a Christmas card in between now and December 25th. And also, if you can, help out with his commissary fund at the Albemarle County, Virginia Regional Jail. Now, the NBC documentary crew actually stayed with Jacob and his parents for a week, and they interviewed him twice on camera there at the jail before he was extradited. And then they had a great opportunity to get a lot of very sympathetic and humanizing footage of Jacob's parents and his family after they had spent the weekend with myself and my family here. We all had an opportunity to talk about Jacob, and also they visited with several of his friends. When they visited with some of his friends, they actually filmed the construction of some shield wall phalanx shields, which will be used by our defensive arm, the Shield Wall Phalanx, and future Shield Wall Network protests and demonstrations and rallies. And these look very good. You can also get the information about the Shieldwall Phalanx and the Shieldwall Network through our website, theroperreportsite.wordpress.com, or through whitenationalists.com, or by going to the Shieldwall Network website itself, which is shieldwallnetwork.wordpress.com. Once again, that's shieldwallnetwork.wordpress.com, or you can go to one of the two Roper Report blogs, the website where I have daily updated news and political opinion articles at whitenationalist.com or theroperreportsite.wordpress.com. To access the Shieldwall Network website, if you cannot remember shieldwallnetwork.wordpress.com for any reason, then you can literally just type in arianwarrior.com. When you type in arianwarrior.com, a shield will come up with the Shieldwall Network logo on it, and it will ask, "Are you an Aryan warrior?" And then it will say, "Click the shield to find out more." When you click on that shield at arianwarrior.com, it will take you directly to the Shieldwall Network website, where you can read about upcoming events, how to find like-minded people, an article called "What is the Shieldwall Network Plan? Project New America," which I've discussed over the previous two episodes of the Roper Report, Billy's Balkanization Podcast. You can read about the role of the Shieldwall Phalanx, our defensive arm, which created the shields, which you'll see in the NBC documentary to be released discussing Jacob Goodwin's case, and how you can join the Shieldwall Network. Also, every day, there are new articles published on the Shieldwall Network website about prepping and community activism, as well as grassroots outreach and organization. Once again, that's arianwarrior.com or theshieldwallnetwork.wordpress.com. And you can see the pictures of the shields and get to know some of the members of the Shieldwall Phalanx. You can also get that address, so how you can write Jacob Goodwin and donate funds to his commissary in the Charlottesville jail. So thank you once again to all of you who have given generously to Jacob Goodwin's legal defense fund. And if you prefer to give just to help his lawyers, then I don't want to dissuade you from doing so. But I will tell you that due to all the generous contributions, we now have raised over $5,000 for Jacob Goodwin's legal defense. And right now, we feel that's adequate. And I'll definitely let you know, and his parents will let you know, if those funds are depleted to the point where the lawyers need more money to continue with his legal defense in between now and December the 14th, which is his next hearing. But right now, his legal defense fund is adequate. We're hopeful that people who would like to donate to Jacob Goodwin will now give, rather than to his legal defense fund, to his commissary fund, which you can go to albemarle.org, or just by Googling the Charlottesville Regional Jail Inmate Canteen Fund. Now, as the Shieldwall Phalanx grows, as a representation of the growth of the Shieldwall Network, we've just received a shipment of new patches with the Shieldwall Network logo on them, and these Phalanx patches will be given to full Phalanx members, of course, not just to any Shieldwall Network affiliates or members. These patches will now equip 20 new Shieldwall Phalanx warriors. And you'll be able to see the uniforms of the Shieldwall Network showing those new patches on the Shieldwall Network and the Roper Report websites if you visit there. Now, when this NBC camera crew came, the gentleman who stuck with me, named Ed, was Taiwanese, but not really. He was half Japanese and half Chinese, as he told me, with a little bit of Asian island aboriginal thrown in. And he had been born in Taiwan to these mixed race parents, all some kind of Asian admixture, and then raised when he was young in Victoria, British Columbia, but most of his life had been spent in different diplomatic areas overseas in green zones in the Middle East because his parents were in the Taiwanese diplomatic corps. And he began to interview me about the Shieldwall Network and about Jacob Goodwin and about our views. And I rapidly became aware of the fact that he could not identify with my perspective. And, you know, this is not my first rodeo, folks. You know, I've been interviewed by blacks and by Jews and by Mexicans, all of whom have, to some degree, a sense of their own culture, their own heritage, and most importantly, their own identity. But Ed was not objective, could not be professional, I didn't feel, because he could not identify with having an identity. He is one of those rootless, cosmopolitan, multinational consumers who doesn't have any foundation to build his life on. He has really no race. He has no nation. He has no home. He has nothing that he can identify with larger than himself and his conspicuous consumption in order to avoid authenticity. It's very sad. And the longer we spoke over the course of about 3 days, the more evident it began to me that, you know, his rootlessness, his loss of identity, his lack of knowing who he was or where he belonged was really endemic of a lot of people these days, even those who are not, as he was, multi-ethnic. Even his passport, which he showed me, didn't even list a nation of origin. And so it was impossible for Ed to empathize with my position, which I didn't necessarily want him to join up, obviously. He wasn't eligible. But it was impossible for him, even as a journalist, to be objective because my worldview was as alien to him as his was to me, and we might as well have been extraterrestrials from different planets as far as our ability to even have a common understanding to have much of a conversation based on. And I have no idea exactly when that NBC documentary will be released or exactly in what venues. I believe that they'll put 5-minute snippets up on the internet first to advertise it as trailers, and then it'll be a full release. And I hope, my whole goal with this really, was not self-aggrandizement or to discuss my organization or my views or to debate him. I really care less what he thinks about us because he's not one of us. But my whole point in trying to bring this NBC documentary crew in was to get Jacob's story out there, to make more of the controlled media and therefore more of our people aware of what's going on in Charlottesville, that these 5 and now 6 young men are now locked up. And the government does not want you to know about them. And that's true. Obviously, the day that Jacob was extradited, his mom got a letter from the governor explaining that apparently he felt like he had no choice, which he didn't. He had a choice. She also got a letter from people saying that, oh, they could not cover the story, but most people didn't even respond because I know for a fact every media outlet in Arkansas knew about Jacob's extradition fight. I know that because I made sure of it. And not a single one, with the exception of one female reporter in the Searcy Daily Citizen local paper, would cover his extradition fight at all. But the day that he was extradited, every news outlet in the state reported his extradition, most of them before I even knew about it. What does that tell you, folks? It tells you that the controlled media, even in Arkansas, on a statewide basis, they acted in collusion with the state government to try to silence any discussion of Jacob Goodwin's case until he was out of the state. They acted in collusion with one another to censor his story so that he could not be humanized, so that sympathy could not be created for him, and so that his extradition could not be delayed, even though hundreds of people signed the petition online to delay it. Even though the governor and his office and his wife received thousands of phone calls and emails and IMs and faxes begging him to meet with the family and to look at our side of the perspective. It was collusion on a massive scale, on a statewide scale. And I know it happens to other people all the time, everywhere. And this was another opportunity for me to experience it personally. And it deepened my disgust and my frustration and my hatred of those colluders. So, when Ed was talking to me, I believe that I remained objective and dispassionate. Ed was unable to because he is rootless, because he has no foundation, nothing larger than himself that he can identify with and that would make it possible for him to understand our perspective. But he was defensive and thin-skinned and emotional about it because he knew that I was right. He felt that emptiness and that longing in his heart, that lack of identity, that rootlessness. It's something very painful and very personal, and I had hit a nerve. But regardless of his personal reaction, I hope that the NBC documentary crew will be fair, but I most importantly hope that they will get something published, that they will have something broadcast before Jacob's trial is over. And that was my whole purpose in trying to get them to come and to interview him and to interview his mother and his friends. I wanted to have the opportunity to get Jacob's story out there, past the controlled media blockade, so that other people would be aware of his case and the case of the other Charlottesville defendants and be able to help out, so that the government there in Charlottesville, as corrupt, perverse as it is, would not be able to railroad these guys in the darkness without any justice. I wanted to shine a light. I did not have a candle myself, so I used NBC in their spotlight, and I hope it worked. It was worth it all if it did. All I want is for Jacob to come home free, without a felony conviction, and be back with his family and his friends again. And I believe that will happen. I sincerely believe that he will win. I believe it may be a couple of months from now. But in the meantime, I encourage you to write to him and to help out with his commissary fund, and I appreciate all of you who have helped out with the legal defense fund and who have already written him. Now, over last week, Mr. Don Black of Stormfront had an opportunity to speak to the Tennessean newspaper as one of four people interviewed after the Shelbyville demonstration, the White Lives Matter rally. And Mr. Black discussed my balkanization theory and how people are voting with their feet. And he himself talked about how he is moving soon from Florida to Tennessee, from the Deep South to the Upper South, in a direct reflection of what I call the balkanization of America, as we polarize and as we go to our separate corners and divide. And as the Deep South, the Black Belt, becomes darker and more black, whites in the South are responding by voting with their feet and doing a white flight on a regional basis from the Deep South to the Upper South. And he talked about how this was something he'd been planning for years, and it was a trend that was coming because racial separation and balkanization was, as he said, and correctly so, inevitable. Now, Dr. Michael Hill, the president of League of the South, also lives in northern Alabama in the white area above the Black Belt, north of the black region of the Deep South, which blacks are going to call New Africa when they have the opportunity. And that northern Alabama region, just like northern Georgia, is adjacent and contiguous to eastern Tennessee, where Mr. Black is living. And I believe that here in Ozarkia, once we have an opportunity to meet in the middle, in the smoldering ruins of Memphis, and take over that stretch of the Mississippi River Valley, that Ozarkia and that Appalachian area could very well merge. However that plays out, it was very heartwarming and inspiring to read Mr. Don Black in the Tennessean article discuss the balkanization theory and the breakup of America, as well as the rise of new white ethnostates. I'm also in conversation with a gentleman who is doing in New England exactly what we are doing with the Shieldwall Network here in Arkansas. They are building a white ethnostate there in Maine and Vermont and New Hampshire. And I am learning from him as he is learning from us. We're sharing ideas and tactics and strategies. And you'll be able to read future articles from him soon on the Roper Report website, where he gives insight and analysis and advice to those working on building a PLE, a pioneer little Europe, or a white ethnostate in your majority white region. If you don't have one in your area, you can move to one, and we'll help you find one closest to you. So, Jacob is doing well. He is still upbeat and still positive, but we need to make sure that we continue to support him, not just financially through his commissary fund, but psychologically and emotionally as well. You know, the Jews are really black-pilled. They're really desperate. They are tearing each other's throats out. I'm not just talking about, you know, Al Franken and Dustin Hoffman and all the others that have been called out by their own Jewish feminist for groping one another. I'm talking about Jews in general. Their desperation is tangible. They smell blood in the water, and it's their own. They know that their chutzpah has gone too far, but they just cannot help it. They can't help themselves, and so they know that the backlash is coming, and it's coming soon, ladies and gentlemen. It's going to probably make all of their worst nightmares and fantasies about World War II and the Holocaust come true, except on a larger scale. Because this time, we're going to finish the job. And they know that. It's time for them to make Aliyah now, before it's too late. Now, I want to thank you all for listening to this episode of The Roper Report, Billy's Balkanization Podcast, as I share with you my thoughts about Thanksgiving and the importance of the holiday, along with its history and its heritage as part of our white culture. I want to thank you all for continuing to support Jacob Goodwin by writing to him, and by now, instead of giving to his legal defense fund, perhaps you could help out with his commissary fund there in the Charlottesville jail. And I want to thank you all for looking at the Shieldwall Network website and the Roper Report website so that you can get daily updates in between these Roper Report podcasts about news and political events, which you will not hear about anywhere else, guaranteed, and how you can get started to become a person of influence in your community with the help of the organizational experience of the Shieldwall Network. For those of you in the Arkansas area or surrounding states, we have a Shieldwall Network meeting coming up in Central Arkansas on December the 2nd, and for information about how you can get involved and attend that, I encourage you to email me at roper_billy@yahoo.com. Once again, that's December the 2nd in Central Arkansas for our next Shieldwall Network meeting, and you can email for more information, roper_billy@yahoo.com. Also, I'd like to request once again, as winter closes in and as the weather gets colder, that you support the Cover Our People with Love pro-white charity. You can find the Cover Our People with Love pro-white charity online by Googling it or by emailing my wife, Tina Roper, at tinalroper@gmail.com, or of course, email me and I'll put you in touch with her. You can find out how you can help provide handmade and handcrafted quilts and blankets and caps and scarves and mittens and socks and warm weather gear. They're all handcrafted with love to white children and needy white families this year. Remember to nominate those who might be in need so we can help them out. And if you'd like to send yarn or quilting material or fabric, you can do so to P.O. Box 1937, Mountain View, Arkansas, 72560, or you can send funds to help purchase those for the Cover Our People with Love pro-white charity through PayPal to roper_billy@yahoo.com. Once again, as always, thank you for listening. This is Billy Roper for The Roper Report, Billy's Balkanization Podcast, reminding you, as always, to think racially, act locally, but no matter what, keep it white.
Can you hear the student band? I think they're getting out of hand. Will you know what happened to those who complain? We've got to stop them seeing light. Let them think it's all right, 'cause the fireworks aren't to keep them entertained. Well, the wells have not run dry. Do we really need to lie? We'll say it's a national emergency. We'll set a wedding full of clowns, and we'll kick them while they're down. Get the banks control, 'cause they are friends to me. Let's go and find a better place. We'll call it New America. Won't it be a lovely place to be? Material, the mind of New America, the best idea since democracy.
You are listening to Radio Aryan for an alternative to the anti-white system on RadioAryan.com.